I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Vicky Galbeka. She's director of Regional Center for Border Rights. It's part of the ACLU of New Mexico, and she's speaking to us from Las Cruces today. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
So issues of immigration, which we're going to talk about today, are often discussed in the media on the basis of myths and generalities and a lot of emotion, as opposed to facts and research. So I thought we could talk about some of the facts, especially as they relate to questions surrounding comprehensive immigration reform, which is being talked about in Congress. One thing that I have learned from the work that you're doing, which I did not know, is that the size and cost of the Border Patrol is very, very high. The Customs and Border Protection, which is the umbrella group of the Border Patrol, is the largest law enforcement agency in the United States, and it takes up $18 billion. What are we getting for that $18 billion?
Well, we're getting a lot of personnel, a lot of technologies, and all, you know, I think the most remarkable increase has been personnel and technologies, along with the building of 652 miles of fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border. So it has been quite a lot of taxpayers' monies that are being spent on immigration enforcement. In fact, I think we sort of did the math and broke down exactly what that meant along the U.S.-Mexico border. And of the 21,000-plus Border Patrol agents that are deployed at the border, 18,500 are actually here in the southern border, and that breaks down to about 10 Border Patrol agents per linear mile. So that meant that if you lined up the Border Patrol agents from San Diego to Brownsville, they could quite literally see each other.
Right.
And this number, by the way, does not include the Office of Field Operations officers, who are also known as customs officers. That's what they were used to be called. It doesn't include FBI, DEA, ATF, all those U.S. Marshals, Secret Service, all the other federal agents that are deployed along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Now, the University of Arizona Center for Latin American Studies has recently done a report on migrant border crossing. What did they study? I mean, is their study something that kind of gives us, in your view, a picture of what's going on at the border?
Yeah, this recent study, which was just issued last Thursday, is actually a very remarkable study, because what they did was they interviewed thousands of migrants in the shelters in Mexico on the northern border and began to ask them a series of questions about what their experience was like. So what was interesting about this study, and actually there have been other studies that have also illustrated this, like, for example, the Kino Border Initiative in February also issued a similar study. Currently, there's an effort along the northern Mexican border where they're also documenting what the experience is like. And what I find probably the most interesting thing about these studies is that more and more, the people who are being separated from their families, it is about family separation. So these are individuals who are not just lone individuals crossing into the border for a job. What it turns out that these are people who have ties to families in the United States that have U.S. citizen children and U.S. U.S. citizen members of their family. So, for example, this particular study, the one that University of Arizona just finished, showed that one out of every two people who are deported have a family member who's a U.S. citizen, and one out of four have U.S. citizen children back home. So very clearly illustrating the reasons why that we really need to reform our immigration system so that this doesn't continue happening.
One of the things that I think is very important for people to understand is the difference between cyclical and permanent migration. And permanent migration is people who come to the United States, establish their families, put down roots, and stay. Cyclical is people who go back and forth and maybe work here for a period of time or a number of years and then go home. And one of the things that's said in this report is that border enforcement, this increased border enforcement that we're seeing, has led to permanent migration. Explain that to us.
Well, basically, I think that what the report showed was that when it's harder for people to leave and come back. It used to be a time that people would come here, work for a little bit, then go back home with their family members. And now what they seem to be doing more of is bringing their families here or establishing families here in the United States. And therefore, the sealing, the attempt to seal off the U.S.-Mexico border is actually trapping people in this country and putting them in this sort of situation where they can't become legal citizens, even though they're contributing as far as to our economy and to our culture. They cannot actually get that access to citizenship because of the way our current immigration policies are written. And that just highlights more the need for having to revise this very outdated system that hasn't been updated in decades.
One of the things about the increased border enforcement, and we'll talk about some of the different programs and how they're working, is that there is this idea that if you have more guards on the border, it will deter people from coming. Does that deterrence work?
Well, I guess the question that begs to be asked is, what will it take for you to be away from your family? And I think this report really shows this really well. It illustrates this. How family, which is a real crucial, important part of people's lives, is a driving factor in a lot of what we do in our lives. There is no immigration policy, no sealing of the border that's going to prevent us from being with the people that we love to be with. And so I think that's where there's this need to look at what our outdated immigration process has done and created this sort of untenable situation of family separation. And we're not stepping back and looking at the whole picture. Instead, all we're doing is spending billions of dollars in enforcement and trying to seal the border. And we're not stepping back and looking at the whole picture as to why people are migrating and why we can't just focus only on law enforcement and on sealing the borders. To me, I think of it as sort of an equivalent would be if a mayor said, you know, we're not going to spend any more money in schools or any programs for children or any parks or any libraries until we have completely eliminated crime in the city, for example. And that's
right.
an untenable situation. Obviously, we need to step back, look at the whole picture, understand the reasons for migration, understand that people move. They move for better opportunities. I think there was a study that I was looking at that showed that 70% of U.S. citizens don't live in the county they were born in. I mean, that's how we move. We move for a better opportunity or to create our families or to feed our families. And we do that within the United States. And so it makes sense that people, with a lot of courage, by the way, come to this country to move their family ahead, to provide better lives for their children. And so that's why they come to this country. And by us creating this harsh enforcement, doesn't really do a lot of service except create a lot of suffering for people along the border and in the interior.
So you've said several times these words, seal the borders, but as we know from biology, as we know from physics, it's very hard to make an impermeable border, and it's very hard to make an impermeable national border because there's so much legal traffic going back and forth anyway. And one of the things that I think is interesting and important to talk about is how it affects the U.S. economy when you try to slow down border traffic. What happens?
Well, I mean, I think you're bringing up a really good point because the ports of entry at the U.S.-Mexico border are vital for the U.S. economy. I think there was an estimate that I read that, you know, 6 million jobs in the United States, one in every 24 workers, actually depend on the commerce between the two nations. And every day there's about 400,000 people who enter legally through our southern ports. This is an area that we cannot ignore. I personally have lived on the border for about 25 years. And I personally have seen how businesses along the border have been affected by these enforcement policies. It used to be people would come up here shopping all the time and go to the malls, and there was all these malls along the U.S.-Mexico border, and now those are all shut down because people aren't coming to the U.S. to buy anymore. And we really have to take into consideration, again, stepping back and looking how immigration contributes to our economy. People who just come across to do shopping, as well as people who bring new technologies to the country.
What do you mean by new technologies?
Well, I mean, I think that when we look at, particularly in the national dialogue around immigration reform, there have been a lot of conversations about how we need people who, to come to this country, not only to, you know, do the low, I guess, the low-skilled, I guess that's the word they use, even though, you know, the worker that on the farms of picking fruit and things like that and the construction work, not only do we need people in that sector, but we also need people to bring jobs to this country through innovative technologies, like, for example, in computer and the science world to create jobs there. And certainly there have been numerous examples of people who have come to this country and have developed or created large corporations that have provided jobs for American citizens.
We're talking to Vicky Galbeca, Director of the Regional Center for Border Rights in Las Cruces. Now, the picture that you're painting, I mean, there's a lot of facets to this whole issue of what's going on at the border, but one of them, as you've talked about, is people come and more men than women cross the border without proper documentation or visas, get established, get a job here. Then women cross to join them, their families, women and sometimes children, and because the border is difficult to cross, establish themselves here in the United States. And many of the people whom you talked to who had been deported or whom the study talked to had lived in the United States for 7, 8, 9 years or more. When women cross the border, they face their own set of problems. What is it like for women who are crossing from Mexico into the United States?
Well, just by way of background, our office actually, while we're under the umbrella of the ACLU of New Mexico, we work with the ACLU of Texas and ACLU of Arizona and ACLU San Diego, and along with other immigrant rights groups along the entire U.S.-Mexico border. And so we've had the opportunity to travel to each region, and actually in Mexico and northern Mexico as well. And you bring up an issue that is kind of another part of some of the tragedy that we see along the U.S.-Mexico border, is that women is a much more vulnerable population when they're crossing. Because I think that once I heard that somebody said, well, we tell the women to take birth control with them when they cross, because they're more susceptible to being victims of violence and of rape and things like that, not just by the coyotes, the smugglers, the people who are smuggling them across, but by some of the dangerous elements on their trip across or through northern Mexico. And then we have had a couple of examples of women who have experienced abuse at the hands of even people who are federal agents along the U.S.-Mexico border, U.S. federal agents.
Some of the parts of this report read like something out of another century. I mean, you literally have armed bandits stopping groups of people, raping the women, stealing the money from whatever little bounce of money they have from the men. And there is also an issue because of the increased border enforcement along the border. There is this problem, which is the routes that people who are coming over to work are taking are the same routes that drug traffickers are taking. And that is not a good combination.
It's not. And unfortunately, that has led to this conflation of drug trafficking with human trafficking or smuggling across the U.S.-Mexico border. And also, you know, and I can't remember the report mentions this or not, but one of the things that we certainly have heard is that people, since it's becoming harder and harder to cross, not only is it's becoming much more expensive to cross, and the drug cartels have actually turned it into a business. It used to be just a regular smuggler would just smuggle somebody across the border for a certain amount of money, and now it's actually something that the cartels have gotten involved and become part of. And so then they strike these little deals to individuals who may not be able to afford paying the smuggling cost. They actually wind up asking them, well, I'll smuggle you across at a reduced rate if you agree to carry whatever drug across the border, like a couple bales of marijuana or something.
Right.
And so it's creating this situation where, and again, I think it's because of that tunnel vision that we have right now related to our immigration policy. We're focusing only on law enforcement and not stepping back and creating a process for people to come. People who, by the way, we need here. We need to have a better balance, to meet not only our labor needs, but we need to balance that out with workers' rights, et cetera. What's really imperative, though, is that when we only focus on law enforcement, that's not going to do the trick. It's a very narrow approach to deal with this issue. It's actually creating more problems in some instances.
Speaking again about the problem of violence against women and this whole picture that you just painted of people being essentially put into the position of being drug smugglers when they're trying to come over here just to do honest work, how could that be prevented?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that we're not focusing on how to reform the immigration process. And if we did have a good immigration process in place, and hopefully that's something that in the next coming months, our congressional members will be able to take leadership in developing one that actually recognizes what the true need is for an immigration process, and that would, in some way, it would eliminate this need or this problem, some of the problems that are coming up because we don't have a good, and the fact that all we're doing is spending money on law enforcement. And the other thing that we should mention also is the need for more accountability and oversight of law enforcement.
Yeah, I was going to get to that in a moment. There are some real problems and abuses on the border, and we can talk about some of those. For example, well, what is Operation Streamline?
Operation Streamline is actually a program that's an agreement between the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice that was first piloted in Del Rio, Texas, back in 2005. And the idea was that instead of apprehending an individual and then deporting them back to usually Mexico or to some Central American country, what they do is they take these individuals and they hand them over to U.S. Marshals, and the U.S. Marshals take them over to the federal courthouse where they face charges of illegal entry and illegal reentry. And now illegal entry is a misdemeanor, which they basically have turned immigration into a crime by doing this. So illegal entry results in a sentence up to 6 months in a federal prison. So then if they get that sentence that long, they wind up going to the federal prison, finishing out their sentence, and then when they're done with a sentence, they get handed back to ICE for deportation proceedings. So it's created this new cycle. And an illegal reentry, is a felony, and that actually is punishable up to 20 years in federal prison if it's combined with an aggravated felony. And so what happens is that individuals who are being apprehended are not just going through the civil immigration procedure of deportation. They're also going through this criminal procedure now. And unfortunately, that's resulting in, another huge expense. It's also diverting really important judicial resources away from dealing with more serious crimes along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Well, they're also being tried, and this is one of the things that I found shocking, they're being tried en masse. So there will be a bunch of 5, 10, 20, 30, I don't know how many people who are shackled for 6 hours, who are literally in chains, brought before a judge without individual counsel, sometimes without counsel who even tells them what they're signing. They're asked to sign these documents that they often don't understand, and then are deported. I mean, it doesn't even sound like that's constitutional.
In the criminal course, they do have counsel, but it's very, you're right. And I don't know if you've ever had an opportunity to see this or not, but in Tucson, for example, it's 70 people a day that they process through Operation Streamline. And what happens is, in the morning, they meet with a federal public defender, or in some cases with panel attorneys that are part of the assigned to represent them. And that very morning, they're just basically told how to plea. And in the afternoon, they go through the whole process. And it really, it's a miscarriage of justice, really, because what it does look like is mass assembly justice. And for the consequences that they're facing, it's pretty dramatic. And the fact that more and more as this program, the older this program gets, the longer it seems that the sentences become. And many of the people who faced illegal entry charges are now facing illegal reentry charges, and it just creates another process by which it's very punitive. And again, it's just we're basically criminalizing people who are just seeking a better opportunity for their families or finding a way to feed their families, and yet we're throwing them into jail for that.
Right, right. Now, there are other abuses that go on the part of the Border Patrol. What other kinds of things happen?
Well, for a number of years now, there have been several groups like No More Deaths who have been documenting this. This University of Arizona study is another example of the kinds of abuses that have been registered. And what's happened is that there has been this massive, very quick growth of Border Patrol agents that have been deployed along the U.S.-Mexico border. And this has happened, unfortunately, with an increase in human and civil rights violations. And so one of the things that we're advocating for is more accountability and oversight. There needs to be better training of these agents along the border. And whenever there is any kind of abuse, they need to be held accountable for this kind of abuse. And I think that it's a natural, organic expectation for citizens, for example, to have citizen review boards of the local police to ensure that human and civil rights violations or excessive use of force can be prevented, so that injuries and deaths can be prevented. The same thought goes behind this idea of an accountability mechanism of Customs and Border Protection officials to ensure that there isn't any more abuse or that these can be prevented. So some of the things that we have seen is that things such as not giving them food and enough food and water, verbal abuse, saying disparaging racial comments, to physical abuse, to cases of actually excessive use of force. And we're actually in coalition have actually documented since January 2010 at least 20 deaths that were the result of Border Patrol agents. And in some of these cases, it was very obvious that there was an excessive use of force. And so we want these cases to be fully investigated publicly, the reports released publicly, and that some measures are taken to prevent any more of these deaths from happening.
We're talking to Vicky Galbeca of the Regional Center for Border Rights in Las Cruces. One of the other things is that when people are deported from the United States to Mexico, sometimes the border authorities will keep their possessions. They'll keep their cell phones, their clothes, all kinds of things. And they'll also keep these people's personal identifying documents. That turns out to be disastrous for these folks who are then landed in Mexico, often far from home.
It does. You know, and it's interesting that people wouldn't get the implications of not having your driver's license or your debit card or your cell phone. I mean, I can't imagine what my life would be like without those items. I think I would be pretty lost. And yet, that's how we're deporting a lot of folks into Mexico, without their IDs and without their cell phones and without their money. In fact, we hear quite often that the Mexican pesos get destroyed as if they weren't real money, and then their money is given, their money is returned to them in a check that they can't cash in Mexico. So it's basically we're deporting people in a more vulnerable state than when we received them, and this makes them more vulnerable to the criminal elements in Mexico. Even, for example, going from the northern border cities in back to their hometown via buses, there's a lot of checkpoints in Mexico that are run by different agencies, the military, the federal police, the county police, and the city police. And if you don't have an identification, some of these police forces in Mexico will pull you off the bus right then and there and begin to really give you a hard time, and then these people never wind up making it back to their hometowns or having to, figure out how to pay some kind of extortion money to get back home.
Speaking of the criminal element, who are Los Zetas, and what are they doing with respect to migrants in border areas?
Well, Los Zetas is a particular family, I guess, of the drug cartels in Mexico. And they're mostly in the northwestern part of Mexico, but they also sometimes collaborate with the Gulf cartel in that part of Mexico, in the Gulf of Mexico. And they, again, this is one of those cartels who has figured out that, or has started to exploit the migrants who are being deported into Mexico, and begin to try to extort their family members in the United States for more money for their safety and things like that, and also using them as drug mules, et cetera.
Now let's talk about some of the ways that deportation happens and that border enforcement happens. What we're talking about right now is largely, well, entirely, the deportation of people who are workers in the United States. A lot of the times people are working construction or restaurant work or whatever. What about people who really are criminals who are in the United States, whether it be drug traffickers or human traffickers? Is this gigantic agency, the Customs and Border Protection, going after really more hardcore criminals which are doing harm to our society?
So Border Patrol does work very closely with, you know, DEA, ATF, and those other federal agents to deport individuals who have committed crimes. But and for a long time, the Department of Homeland Security has said that they will only go after criminal aliens. However, Border Patrol enjoys less prosecutorial discretion. Now, what has happened is that a lot of people, I would say the vast majority of the people who are being deported, have not committed a crime. But there is some that have.
What is the so-called Secure Communities program?
Okay, Secure Communities is actually a program where people who are brought into jails around the country by local police, when they're being booked, they will get, you know, they provide a fingerprint and, you know, basic biographic information. And so what happens is that some of these fingerprints will go through are not only forwarded to FBI to make sure that there's, or to check to see if there's a warrant for this person's arrest or what their criminal background is, it is now in many counties and cities actually being forwarded to the Department of Homeland Security to check and see what their immigration status is as well. So Secure Communities, in essence, that's what the program does. The result, however, is that it's created a very strong lack of trust between community members and local law enforcement, because now, and situations where, for example, in a domestic violence situation, when they bring in both parties, the situation that comes up is that a victim of a crime actually might wind up being deported because of this program. So it's a big concern for us that people are just sort of, that the background, the immigration background of people are being unilaterally checked on people who are being booked in these local jails.
You know, it's funny. I mean, we use these words, like we talked before about sealing the border and how that's just an impossible dream. We talk about secure border. We talk about secure communities. And it seems like these words end up in real life meaning their opposite. I mean, the Secure Communities program, in ways that you've just described, makes for less secure communities if people are afraid, for example, to reach out to law enforcement.
Exactly. I mean, I think if people who are witnesses or victims of crime are afraid of picking up the phone and calling police, then public safety is undermined for everyone. And it's a little bit of doublespeak, actually, when they call these programs things like, you know, secure communities, because it's not. It's actually having a contrary effect. And in fact, the law officers who have sworn an oath to protect the community are now actually the agents of less safety for the community.
What is immigration detention like? We know that a lot of these prisons that immigrants get put into are private prisons. What is it like inside?
It looks very much like a prison. So it's interesting because we're talking about two very different systems. We're talking about civil law, and then there is criminal law. And yet, when you see detainees who have basically committed civil offenses, you're looking at them, when we go and visit them at the detention centers, it looks like you're going into a prison. The Otero County Processing Center here, which holds about 1,000 male detainees, they have basically the detainees held in, there are 50 detainees per pod, and then they have solitary, and when you walk in there, it just looks, it has the bars, and it has them all wearing the prison uniforms. I'm hard pressed to tell you what the difference is between an immigration detention center and a prison.
Except that if it's a civil center, they don't have the right to legal representation.
Exactly. They do have the right to legal representation, but it's not at the cost of the government. So they have to basically figure out to secure resources to be able to get representation. But also, one of the things about some of these detention centers is that they're in very remote locations. The one here in Chaparral is way out in the middle of nowhere, and for a lawyer to get there, and some of these people have been transferred from different parts of the United States, so access to their lawyers in L.A. or New York are very, very difficult.
And so they actually move them around. In your view, is that a purposeful strategy to keep them from having proper representation or to keep them away from their families? What's going on?
Well, it feels like an extraordinarily punitive system. They make it extraordinarily difficult for people to defend themselves from being deported or to defend themselves from any of these programs that are very, very punitive, like Streamline and the other programs, like the alternative. There's a lateral repatriation program, too, that's supposed to make it harder for them to come back. But really all it does is just make their life extraordinarily hard, an already extraordinary life even harder.
Yeah, lateral repatriation means that they put them back in a different part of Mexico that they're not familiar with, which makes, I mean, women way more vulnerable to rape, and both men and women vulnerable to the criminal element in a very extreme way, which is well documented in that report from the University of Arizona.
Exactly.
We're talking to Vicky Galbeca of the Regional Center for Border Rights in Las Cruces. Now let's talk a little bit about comprehensive immigration reform. One of the things that's been talked about for a long time is guest worker programs. What so far has been proposed? What would it look like? What are the, in your view, benefits and disadvantages to guest worker programs as they are being conceived?
Well, there's actually two bills that are being worked on right now, one on the Senate side and the other one on the House side. And the what we know about the House bill is very limited because it's all very, very secret. We don't even know who's working on it. There's a very secretive gang there. And then on the Senate side, there's the leadership has been eight senators who have been working on a bill that, in theory, the rumor on the street is that they're going to release these bills sometime next week. So the exact details of what is going to be in each bill remains to be seen. However, from ACLU's perspective, any bill that does get introduced, what we would hope is that it protects the rights of people, like, for example, worker rights. There should be no creation of a second class of people that don't have the same protections that workers everywhere in this country are entitled to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you have a second class of citizens, that is on its face unconstitutional. I mean, anybody, citizen or non-citizen, living in the United States of America is subject to the provisions of the U.S. Constitution and all its laws.
Correct. So what we want to make, because there has been a lot of conversation about creating for example, there's 11 million people who are here. The estimate's 11 million people who are here without documents. And there have been some proposals that say, well, let's say that it's okay for them to be here and it's okay for them to work, but we're not going to put them on a pathway to citizenship. There have been sort of an extreme proposal. And so what we're saying is that would be creating a second class of people. What you really need to do, what we really want to see, is that these individuals do have a pathway to citizenship that's broad, that's not creating these huge, enormous fines that nobody could afford, or that it doesn't make them wait forever to become citizens.
But let's get back to the issue of guest workers. What kinds of, I mean, I don't know that we really have hammered that out yet in terms of the bills that we've seen or that are about to be introduced, but in general, what kinds of guest worker programs are being considered? Would they have a pathway to citizenship? And what are some of the dangers of guest worker programs?
I mean, I think that, again, I think one of the things that we want to be able to see is that they don't treat guest workers any differently than any other worker in this country. One of the concerns that we have had as the ACLU has had concerns about this E-Verify program, because we want to make sure that this program does not cause any obstacles for citizens from getting jobs. As far as guest worker programs, we just want to make sure that they're fair and that they do respect all the constitutional rights that people have, regardless of citizenship.
What is the E-Verify program? What is the E-Verify program?
E-Verify is a proposal from our view, it feels like very much like a national ID card, but it's a proposal that would some of the proposals have included putting biometric information on this, but it would be a card that everybody has. It has a number, and it has that would allow you to work in this country, like a Social Security card, but with biometric information.
Does it exist yet?
It does not, although, I mean, not the one with the biometric information. All federal agencies are required to go through E-Verify, which is just a large database that you have access to where you plug somebody's name in and birth date, and then it comes back telling you whether you're authorized to work, whether this person is authorized to work in this country or not.
And one of the things about that program, as I understand it, is it has a very high error rate. In other words, it's not a very accurate database.
That is fundamentally, I think, the biggest problem with the database, is it does have a lot of inaccuracies in it.
So you were talking about the senators, the U.S. senators who are working on comprehensive immigration legislation. Some of them were just down here in the Southwest. Were you able to meet with them? What happened?
Yeah, these senators were actually invited. Two of the senators are Jeff Flake from Arizona and John McCain from Arizona as well. And they invited Bennett from Colorado and Carl Schumer from New York to come in and visit the Arizona border. Our concern was that they weren't really going to, that they were just going to get the Border Patrol, you know, the tour by Border Patrol agents. They give a very comprehensive tour of what they've been able to put in place as far as personnel and technologies are concerned. But we had hoped that the senators would meet with community members to sort of hear that other part of the story. Because one of our biggest concerns is that congressional members in D.C. and even White House staff don't really get the big border picture. They have a lot of ideas about what the border looks like and what it is.
Right.
And we're just trying to really, really hard to try to get that message that we're not this, you know, the border region is, the cities on this side of the border are among the safest in the nation. This is the border region is one that is good for the economy. It's a bicultural part of the world. And we're just trying to present a more holistic view of the border in a way, and also to sort of talk about how this sole law enforcement model approach has really been detrimental to border communities. And I mean, the number one complaint that we hear about from, you know, when we travel along the U.S.-Mexico border are these families who have been separated and torn apart and don't know if they're mother or father or brothers are ever going to be able to make it back into the United States to be with them. And it's a tragedy that we're seeing daily along the U.S.-Mexico border. And we need that message to get to D.C., that we don't want to be the architects of suffering here along the border. We need to do something to ensure that families stay together and that we use the border as a resource to this country and not as something where people just picture violence and cartels still over and I don't know what that they envision about the border.
Well, I mean, you do have cartels. You do have drug trafficking. We are the market for drugs. And as long as there is a market for drugs, drugs will be distributed. And we've talked a lot about drug legalization on this show and the idea that cartels are created by having a black market and all of that. But then you have this other picture of economic conditions in these countries, Mexico, Central America, which are related to U.S. policies toward those countries. And I wanted to ask you, what kinds of conditions would it take, what kinds of actions would it take on the part of the United States and Mexico so that people wouldn't want to emigrate in the first place?
Well, I mean, I think that the studies have shown that the Mexican economy is actually doing a little bit better, and the violence problems are, you know, I think it's a very big, complicated problem. But I want to challenge the thinking a little bit in that question, because we know that there's probably drug cartels in Chicago and New York City, and you know, but we don't, there's a bigger narrative about the border than what people are hearing. And that's the narrative we want to change. We want people to hear that we're about families, we're about you know, bicultural, binational families sometimes along the U.S.-Mexico border, and that by and far the contributions of immigrants to this country, as most of us are to this country at some point in our familial history, our contributions have been good, positive ones to this country, and we need to change that narrative about the border to one that's more inclusive and not one that is dangerous and damaging to our communities.
When you talked to those senators who came to the border, were they listening?
I think one thing that they did hear, at least Schumer heard, that there was no more personnel needed. I think that was sort of one step in the right direction. What we're hoping they'll hear is that they have also heard is that we need more accountability and oversight of Border Patrol agents and Customs and Border Protection agents here along the border. And that we really do need to focus on the other pieces of immigration reform, which include legalization and a pathway to citizenship.
And above all, as you guys make it very clear, unification and reunification of families. I mean, the toll that this takes on families is just inestimable.
It is, and it's really, and here's the thing about that I think is really interesting, or I don't think people really get, is that these are U.S. lawful permanent residents, people who are here in the country legally, who are being very affected, traumatized even, torn apart. It doesn't just affect people who are here without documents, who, by the way, many of whom have been trying to get a citizenship or a lawful permanent residency for years, but there's just simply no line for them to stand in. And yet, these are the families. What we're tearing apart are U.S., New Mexican, Texan, Californian, Arizona families. Those are the families that are being affected by these policies. And I think that's what people need to get, that it's not just about us being punitive towards people who are trying to cross into this country in a way without documents or who are trying to take advantage of this country. We're actually making it really hard for our own family members along the border to be successful and to contribute to our economy.
Because basically what you have is scenarios in which a father or mother is taken away from U.S. citizen children, and families have a hard time, I mean, children have a hard time recovering from that, as do their parents.
Very, very hard for the children. And some of the cases that we've registered here in New Mexico, grandparents who are lawful permanent residents are stepping in to take care of their grandchildren because the parents have been deported. And that, you know, the kids, you know, are terrified of police. They're terrified of law enforcement. They're afraid that they're going to wind up being deported to a country they don't know or speak the language. And it's creating a human tragedy that really should be unacceptable because it doesn't come close to our American core values of family unity.
Vicky Galbeca is director of the Regional Center for Border Rights in Las Cruces, which is part of the ACLU of New Mexico. Thank you very much for talking with us today on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.